This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Is now a teachable moment for economists. We're joined by William Spriggs, professor in the Department of Economics, Howard University, and chief economist to the AFL-CIO, who challenges his fellow economists in reaction to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and slams what he sees as their attempts to deny racial discrimination. Dr. Spriggs argues that economists should stop looking for a reason other than racism, some omitted variable, to account for why African Americans are falling further behind in the economy.
Professor Spriggs, thank you for joining us.
What prompted you to write the letter and then the essence of what you were getting at?
It was really a letter to economists to get them to understand their role in policy, and what we project as economists ends up having huge influence on the way that people interpret the world.
And just tie this back into, which is the intent of the letter, it starts from the brutal murder of George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
A letter on the murder of George Floyd to economists? What's the correlation?
People who go to college now and take economics are studying had its birth in the late 19th, early 20th century. Regrettably, all of those economists that helped to establish the American Economic Association were very deeply wrapped up in the eugenics movement of the day that had captured the imagination of America's intelligentsia. Its perverse way, the role of what economics did was to excuse the huge amount of inequality taking place at the time. It's not different than today at all. It was really to get economists to fess up that many of the frames created by these folks who were eugenicists repeat themselves today, and especially when it comes to race. So what these 19th century economists did was pretend, wink, wink, nod, nod, that somehow or another race is this scientific thing and it's an objective reality. There are inferior races. Ironically, the first test case of freedom of speech for faculty and the concept of academic freedom was one of these economists who taught at Stanford. And I think many people, because they hear academic freedom and they want to think that all this must be about progressive ideas, but actually what this economist was doing was writing how horrible it was that the railroads would have brought Chinese workers to the United States, and this will just debase the United States because we're bringing in this inferior race who will only lower our gene pool and make us less stupid as the rest of the world, and this was really bad policy. Well, Leland Stanford took great exception to that and wanted to fire the faculty member. So ironically, the whole thing of academic freedom really had more to do with being free to be a racist. But this is what they believed. They fervently believed, even those economists who weren't in what we would now consider the mainstream of marginal product type economist, neoclassical economist. John R. Commons, who was an institutionalist, even his views were on race specifically, that black workers were really saved by slavery because there's no way that had blacks been brought here as equal immigrants that they could have competed with white workers because they're too stupid and too lazy. This is how raw their phrasing was. Their explanation for the rapid amount of inequality that was taking place is so similar to today that economists have to understand what we do today in excusing inequality, those sets of frameworks. We have not really moved from that, and it is equally dangerous to this moment as it was in their moment, because think about it. That moment, the 19th to the early 20th century, really defines the modern world. If you went from some of their references, because one of them made the ugly reference that we do not need to worry about running the experiment again of wasting white lives for valueless people, making a reference to the Civil War and the fact that white soldiers died on the Union side to end slavery. That ugly quote that, you know, this was such a waste that we would free these unworthy, stupid people. Okay, end of the Civil War to when a lot of the progressive ideas that these economists advanced came to fruition, you have so much technology that could have done good for humankind, the X-ray machine, airplanes that could deliver things so much faster, cars, trucks, electricity, electric lights, the subway in New York. I mean, all of these things came about within that short 40-year period. And you would think with all of those advances in technology that we would have also become more enlightened about ourselves and humans. And instead, as we're commemorating this year, 100 years since the Tulsa riot, it unleashed horrible venom, horrible racism, not just in the United States, of course. We know if we went to Europe,
and
that
we
this was
say
the time
the Tulsa
of,
race massacre. You were just
there were pogroms all over the place in Eastern Europe. What was unleashed at the time was horrors justified on this idea that this growth in inequality was some natural order, that it was in fact meritocracy writ large, and that meritocracy also included the superiority of some races rising above others. What economists do, if you ask them to explain racial gaps, is buy into this idea that race in the United States is some natural thing. When in the 19th century, when these economists were writing, race in America was being defined. Exactly at the moment they're writing, we have Plessy versus Ferguson. And so many people miss the true and deep and ugly meaning of that case because we just concentrate on the separate but equal part, and we find that distasteful. But there was more to that case. I have done lectures on it where I show people a picture and I say, do you know who this is? Most people say no. Then I say, this is Plessy. And they go, okay. They immediately assume that Plessy must be the defendant because he must be the railroad owner or operator who's being sued. And I point out, no. Plessy is the black man who's suing. Plessy's actual argument to the Supreme Court was, I have one black great-grandparent. Therefore, I consider myself white. So when I got on the car and was denied to sit with white people, that's what I was being denied. And the court said on two counts. One, can the state of Louisiana regulate access to the car? The court says, yes, there is no harm done to anyone because as long as the facilities are equal, they can be separate. But people forget the other part of their ruling, which was, Plessy, we don't care what you think you are, and we don't care how you look. By the law of Louisiana, you're black. It's that part of the ruling that makes explicit, this is not biological, this is not cultural, this is a legal instrument defining who can and cannot be on this side or that side of some line that I divide, who can join a labor union, who can marry whom, where can they live, what occupation may they have. That's what it did, and economists treat this like kids sitting at a lunch counter and, well, the black kids sit over there, the white kids sit over there, they're all eating lunch, what's the problem? And they present the breadth of American economic history as if it is this long history of competition and it's meritocracy at its heart, and they perpetuate this notion. The losers are inferior in some dimension, and they do it subconsciously. Some of them and others consciously, they don't question why do we divide ourselves that way? And they are apologists for segregation. They don't understand the system as being violent, and they don't understand the system really did mean to reinforce itself. There are a lot of economists who have been quite shocked by the big discussion that has taken place over race restrictive covenants in housing. There are a lot of economists who do urban economics who had never heard of race restrictive covenants. They wrote, neighborhoods are segregated because people like to live around people like themselves. But what about this history of these covenants? What about black homes that were burned? What about fights that would take place, as some of us are familiar with the Hansberry case in Detroit, where the black homeowners had to defend themselves against this white mob? You know, it's like these are people who take all of that and just fluff over it. It becomes frustrating because I think people who read the New York Times article, if they were deeper in their thinking, would have gone, yeah, why are blacks segregated into these occupations, which these economists are saying are the lower paying or the ones that have less mobility? Why do economists think, given that history, that that's just coincidence, or that has nothing to do with that history, or that has nothing to do with the fact that we used race to divide who gets what, which is what economists study? The whole field of economics is the issue of allocation of scarce resources. How do we make those decisions? And yet economists cover their eyes to it. And so that moment was a chance, I had hoped, for them to look and say, do I really believe that this whole machine is colorblind, that what I just saw happen to George Floyd had nothing to do with American history or nothing to do with what race really means? So that's why I wrote the letter, because there is that tendency, and it repeats itself today, in trying to explain the high level of inequality we have now and the way in which a belief that worships inequality hurts all of us, because it presents inequality as this inevitable grind of history and science. People need to accept this inequality as a good thing.
How do economists and others who look at the employment and unemployment situation in the U.S. today explain disparities between the numbers with regard to unemployment of African Americans and whites today in the U.S.? What justifications do they use for these inequalities?
The kinder ones believe that blacks are unequal in training. They blame the American public education system for making blacks non-competitive. When you ask them, how is it that the white high school dropout unemployment rate is lower than the black unemployment rate, they fall back on this notion that black test scores indicate that black people, even if they have college degrees, doesn't really make them equal to whites with college degrees. That's not because blacks are inherently inferior, but all of their schooling is inherently inferior. When you point out that schools aren't that segregated, they shrug it off as, well, but on average, kind of, you know, and then they'll tell some horror story about some urban school system. They'll ignore that the majority of blacks live in the South and don't live in these giant cities that they want to braise as examples of such school systems. They'll rail against Chicago or New York's public school systems. And you go, yeah, but the majority of blacks live in towns like Raleigh and Durham and Fayetteville, North Carolina, or they live in Savannah, Georgia, or Charleston, South Carolina. They don't live in these huge cities. That's not the majority of black people. When the majority of black people, even though they are in segregated schools, aren't in schools as hyper-segregated as they want to call out to explain these gaps. Others will say that it has something to do with the culture of black people, that black people don't value education, and the lower test scores are just reflective of black people not valuing education. And when you point out that Black people, if I control for family income and the students' characteristics, Black kids are far more likely to apply to college than anybody else. Economists know this because this is the kind of thing we do all the time, because then we get into what are the returns to college and that sort of thing. We know this, but the coefficient on race says Black people seek higher education more than anybody else, and Black women like quadruple anybody else. You ask them, well, where does this argument about culture come from? Because every shred of data says that Black people get more education if the playing field were level than anybody else. It's not culture. Then they just want to shrug. But they're accepting the gap because the discipline conditions them that by some hook or by some crook, people, we don't know what it is, but there's something about them that makes them less competitive in the labor force. Therefore, their inequality represents that inferiority.
Professor Spriggs, in a period where the world is crying out in the wake of the murder of George Floyd for racial justice, do we see any kind of remedial action being taken by the various employers or institutions that should be looking at the issue of the economics of the Black community as an essential component agenda issue for any form of racial justice?
It is astounding that economists don't look at constants the way that you would think they would. So there is this constant wage gap. It closes in the period 1946 to 1970. When we took dramatic changes to the institutions in which Black workers mediate getting jobs, that includes incorporating Black workers under the protection of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the federal government ending discrimination and hiring. It includes the effect of increased union density during that period for Black workers. They were skating on the effect of World War II and the high union density that Black workers achieved right after World War II, much higher than for white workers. All of that drove a convergence, and then it froze when we undid all of those institutional factors. This flatlining coincides with a restoration to a previous equilibrium in terms of the ability of the labor market to allocate jobs and the stability of the pay gap. You see in the stability of the unemployment gap, you see in the stability of the employment, if you looked at the employment to population share. All of those things are constant. No matter what I put into this machine that gives me this answer, it has to be something about the machine. There is an efficient point, if people are colluding, where you would reach an equilibrium. And so if you go above it, then it hurts the system because you would be denying productivity from taking place that would be really, really, really beneficial. You drag everybody down in ways that hurt everybody in a way that is counterproductive to the idea of colluding. That is what we're watching. It becomes costly to the system when it creates the fragility that we saw caused by the pandemic. The system, in generating this level of inequality, keeps the system from being robust. It is so unequal that this part of the inequality comes home loudly. The amount of money we've had to pump into the economy is the direct result of the economy would collapse, but for making up for this huge amount of money that needs to be at the bottom of the distribution. Unless we're willing to engage in more disruption to how jobs are allocated, we can't move the unemployment gap. We can't move this wage gap. We have to be as vigorous on opening up against discrimination. We have to be more serious about discrimination in hiring, discrimination in employment, than we have been in the past. We've gone asleep on that because we've convinced ourselves, and economists have thoroughly convinced us, that none of that mattered. The only thing that matters is an individual's education. Until we shake that, then we can't make the change. We know some instruments that are helpful in that. We know that the high level of union density during the period of 46 to 70 helped ameliorate the tendency for discrimination to creep into how jobs were allocated. We had a non-discriminatory labor union movement at that point. And in fact, we know that there are some other things that happen positively because of that labor movement. We know that whites in the labor movement, as a result of this change in what our labor movement became over that period, that whites are less racist as a result of being in the labor movement. Current labor market is going to shake some things up because it has opened up a lot of job opportunities that hadn't been there. So a lot of the very low-wage workers that employers were able to rely on because they had them as captive, these employers were taking advantage of the high level of residential segregation, the high level of racial and ethnic segregation, the high level of income segregation, so that they really were dealing with pockets of workers who didn't see the entire labor market and became dependent on these kind of employers because they knew once they ventured outside of that little pocket, they would face more discrimination. The economy is expanding in different ways now in some industries. The need of workers who have been displaced because of the pandemic to find new jobs and new job opportunities has created a problem for those low-wage employers. They're no longer able to take advantage in the way they had in the past. They want to, in some of these states, claim they can't find workers because of unemployment benefits. They can't find workers because these workers who have been captive to them are suddenly finding other opportunities. It's almost like the movement of blacks out of the South into the North, the Great Migration. And a similar sort of thing is happening today. And that's why some of these employers can't find anybody, because those job networks have opened up to other opportunities. Some industries that have been locked out and need workers are beginning to absorb them. So we know there are things we can do to disrupt these hierarchies and do it in a good way. But that also means we need policymakers to speak from that perspective, to say, I don't expect this level of inequality. And I don't think it's going to happen because of training or education. I think it's going to happen because I change institutions. We need more policymakers to not accept inequality, but to preach against inequality and to give us a vision of what the world would be like if things were more equal, which would be a far better world for everybody.
Professor Spriggs, so many of our institutions, which are so steeped in white supremacy, so systemically enmeshed in institutional racism, that we should have to have letters that jolt the conscience and the consciousness of, yes, the academy, yes, the institutions that rule and control economically, and indeed the educational institutions in every institution within our society. Having said that, were there specific responses to your letters, which was commented on by the New York Times, were there specific indications that the economists heard and would begin to understand and respond accordingly to the issue of racism that riddles their lens in understanding economic relations within this society?
I take comfort in two places where I think things have changed. The Federal Reserve now openly says that its commitment to full employment means looking at unemployment of everyone, and that they will no longer only look at the top level unemployment rate, but will look at what's happening to black workers and to Hispanic workers and Asian workers, and that they won't accept just one number as telling them the labor market is okay. That is huge, because in the past, in the 1980s, the Fed had convinced itself that the United States could not operate with the unemployment rate below 5%, knowing that meant for the entire decade of the 1980s, every month, black people had unemployment rates above 10%. Only because of COVID have white men in the United States ever had 1 month where their unemployment rate reached 10%. Black men had that every month for the entire decade of the 1980s because the Fed refused to believe the 5% unemployment rate and accepting high levels of unemployment had anything to do with why black workers couldn't break that 10% rate. So to have the Fed say, we should have been paying attention to that, matters. And the fact that the Fed was patient enough with lower unemployment rates to the point where before the pandemic in the fall of 2019, we finally got the unemployment rate for Latino adult men and white men to be equal. That would not have happened in the past. They would have slowed the economy. They would have sworn that the labor market was tight. They would have sworn that everybody who got a job, who could actually work and be productive, had a job. And they would have continued what they had been doing in 2017, which was to try and slow the economy. They reversed course when the black and Hispanic unemployment rate showed some difficulties. And because of that, in the fall of 2019, we got Latino and white men to have the same unemployment rate, and inflation did not go through the roof. We didn't have wheelbarrows buying groceries because the dollar had fallen to some horrible level. The earth was not coming apart. And so I take that and the fact that the Fed had a whole discussion to try and convince themselves and others that maybe this is what we should be doing and what we should be about. Using race as a lens to justify inequality is a dangerous crutch. It works in the opposite direction. And if you don't accept racial inequality, it becomes a lot easier to not accept inequality at all. And in fact, to think that somebody's doing something, that the rich aren't getting this rich just because of meritocracy. It was a crutch that economists used because once people accepted their inferior races, so we can accept inequality. If you're going to accept inequality, then you're in trouble.
We've been speaking with William Spriggs, professor of economics at Howard University and chief economist at the AFL-CIO, whose open letter, and I quote, is now a teachable moment for economists, end quote, is a must read. You can Google it under that title. Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash for Building Bridges. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.